Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Sunday marks 6 months since the brutal attack by Hamas in Israel. And in the early days following that attack, President Joe Biden visited Israel to offer his full support of Israel's right to defend itself, advising caution that the response be measured. The U.S. continues to support Israel with arms while backing off rhetorically. In recent weeks, the president has characterized Israel's actions as over the top and its bombing campaign indiscriminate. On Monday night, Israeli airstrikes killed 7 workers from World Central Kitchen who were distributing aid in Gaza. Israel's military chief of staff, Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, said in a statement issued yesterday that, quote, it was a mistake that followed a misidentification. It shouldn't have happened. World Central Kitchen founder Chef Jose Andres told Reuters yesterday that he believes Israel targeted the WCK convoy. Worldwide condemnation of the attack was swift. President Biden said he was outraged and heartbroken. One of the victims was a U.S.-Canadian dual citizen. Biden criticized Israel for not doing enough to protect aid workers and to let supplies reach the more than 1 million Palestinians who are facing starvation. Yet despite the criticism of its prosecution of the war, military aid to Israel from the United States continues. Prominent Democrats, including Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, have called for a ceasefire and the release of the remaining hostages that Hamas is holding. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the highest-ranking elected Jewish official in the U.S. government, has called for new Israeli elections, saying in a speech on the Senate floor last month that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government, quote, no longer fits the needs of Israel. So what should the position of the United States be, and what should Israel do to assure its safety and restore its international reputation? Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Beginning in the late 70s and for nearly 25 years, he served in the State Department as an analyst and negotiator in the Arab-Israeli peace process. He joins us on Zoom. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So how will the attack on the World Central Kitchen convoy affect, do you think, the calculus of Israel when it comes to the planned attack in Rafah near the Egyptian border and the negotiations with Hamas over hostages?
I mean, they're separate issues. Some of them are linked together. I think the Israelis are determined to conclude the final portion of their ground campaign by mounting a significantly large and very kinetic set of military operations in Rafah. Rafah is important because the residual number of Hamas battalions are there, smuggling weapons, arms shipments into Sinai through tunnels. Rafah is important there. I don't think much is going to dissuade the Israelis from doing it. The question is, can they do it in a way that limits and insulates the 1.3 million Palestinians who are displaced from their homes? Rafah had a population of only 300,000 before October 7. The answer to that question is, if the Israelis had 3 months, if they were willing to cooperate with international aid organizations, if they coordinated this activity with the United States and with Egypt, I think a Rafah operation could actually achieve its objectives without endangering the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who are in the vicinity. But they don't have 3 months. So I have a pretty gloomy assessment on what the impact, should the Israeli operation move forward, is going to be. What could dissuade it, what could delay it, would be an Israeli-Hamas deal. And negotiations have been on and off between Hamas and Israel. And I have to remind myself always, this is not one hand clapping. All of the attention, and most of the criticism, as I look at the American media and my own interviews, focus almost exclusively on Israeli behavior. And it's understandable, but this is not one hand clapping. We have to remind ourselves that on October 7th, you had a terror surge, indiscriminate, willfully murdering children, women, civilians, and grabbing 250 hostages. 134 remain. Of those, an estimated 30 were either killed on October 7th, their bodies taken to trade to Gaza, or they died in captivity. So you're dealing with a vicious terror organization that uses Palestinians as human shields. Nonetheless, the exponential rise of Palestinian deaths, I think the Israelis have expanded their rules of engagement. You have a humanitarian catastrophe building in Gaza. And again, here, I'm very gloomy right now. I don't see any way out or any mechanism that would de-escalate, let alone stop this conflict.
What's the end game for Hamas at this point? I mean, is it also true that the more Palestinians who starve, the more Palestinians who are killed in what Joe Biden has called indiscriminate bombing, that helps the cause because it turns yet more people in the international community against Israel? Does Hamas have a vested interest in protecting the lives of Palestinian civilians? Is there any evidence that they care about that?
I think they have to care because they've governed Gaza. And when this is over, Yahya Sinwar, the architect of what happened on October 7th, I'm sure, because who knows, he's ensconced in a tunnel somewhere, meters below ground in a tunnel, either below Khan Yunis or Rafah. I think he has to care. But as far as this campaign is concerned, I think you more or less have accurately described the motivations. The more pressure, the more tensions that exist between the U.S. and Israel, the more upset there is in the Arab and Muslim world as a consequence of Israel's ground campaign, the more isolated the Israelis become. I just think that Hamas may have calculated this would be a trap. Whether or not they believe the Israelis would respond the way the Israelis have. But for the Hamas' senior leadership, let's be clear, this is an existential dilemma. The Israelis, no matter how long it takes, as they did in the wake of the murder of the 11 Israeli athletes in Munich by Black September in 1972, the Israelis will have committed themselves to eliminating the three or four major architects of this campaign. So for this Hamas senior leadership, it's an existential dilemma. I don't think they have a way out, frankly, and I don't think they've thought about it. They will, even if this limited hostage exchange goes forward, the ones they've been negotiating now, 45 hostages, that would be the elderly, the sick, and women hostages in exchange for an asymmetrical number of Palestinian prisoners, probably close to 1,000. Even if that trade goes forward and you get 6 weeks of calm, Hamas will continue to hold 50 IDF soldiers. And the price for releasing those would be a permanent ceasefire and a withdrawal, I'm sure, is what Hamas wants of Israeli forces from Gaza. I don't think that's likely. So I can't game out for you, even if this limited deal goes through, what the end state is going to be.
There is a dichotomy between the rhetoric of the U.S. government, Secretary Blinken, Vice President Harris, President Biden, talking about the need for Israel to scale things back, yet still sending arms. What is Biden's best option in terms of his relationship with Bibi Netanyahu? Can he confront him? Can he, really put a line in the sand and say, you can't cross it, or you've crossed it already, and alienate him in a real and flagrant way? Can he cut off arms? Can he use the leverage that he clearly does have, should he choose to employ it?
You know, since October 7, I described the administration's policy as passive aggressive. There's been an enormous amount of anger, frustration about the way the Israelis have operated. Particularly in view of the exponential rise of Palestinian deaths and humanitarian catastrophe. You've seen the domestic political implications for the president. But the reality is, in my judgment, this has been an exercise of words over deeds, in large part, I think, for two reasons. Number one, this president, alone among his predecessors, perhaps Bill Clinton's regard for Israel came closest, but Joe Biden has this tremendous emotional attachment. The idea of Israel, the people of Israel, the security of Israel, obviously not so much to Benjamin Netanyahu. And in my mind, has been the decisive factor as to why the president has been reluctant and or refused until this very moment, this phone call, it's supposed to be taking place even as we speak, why the president has been reluctant to impose a single cost or consequence on the Israeli government. And the levers at his disposal have been there since the beginning of this conflict. Number one, condition, restrict, slow walk U.S. military assistance to Israel. Number two, introduce a UN Security Council resolution highly critical of Israel, or abstain or vote for someone else's. And number three, abandon the whole notion of negotiating between Israel and Hamas. Just join the international community's consensus and demand an immediate cessation of hostilities. I think it's the emotional attachment of the president to Israel, number one, and it's something else. This right now is not a conflict. We look at it somehow as a conflict between the prime minister of Israel and the president. It's not. If it were just that, the president's leverage would increase. But it's not just that. Benny Gantz, Benjamin Netanyahu's putative successor, if elections were held today, he'd triple the number of seats of his party, and Mr. Netanyahu would not form a government. But Benny Gantz sits in the war cabinet, acquiescing, enabling, and supporting an Israeli ground campaign into Rafah. The Israeli public, not divided, not in fact unified on two things. They want to see the end of Benjamin Netanyahu's prime ministry, but at the same time, they are unified in terms of the goals that he has identified that the IDF is trying to carry out. And again, Israel is not at war with Switzerland here. I'll remind both of us again, this is a conflict between Israel and a vicious terror organization. It was the embodiment of an idea, and that idea is the replacement of Israel with an Islamic State. If this were Israel, war with Egypt, Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, within 3 weeks that war was over. American pressure and persuasion, two disengagement agreements in 18 months laid the basis for Sadat's peace initiative and Menachem Begin's acceptance of that initiative into an historic Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. We're not dealing with that kind of conflict here, and in an existential conflict. And I think the Israelis and Hamas both look at it in that way. There is a serious limitation that of the impact of external actors in such a conflict. Middle East, you know, I spent 27 years in government. The Middle East is littered with the remains of great powers who wrongly believe they could impose their will, their schemes, their dreams, their ambitions on smaller ones. And on this issue, if it were just Benjamin Netanyahu against Joe Biden, fine. But it's not. It's the vast majority of the Israeli public. It's the political elites. And until you see two things happen, Benny Gantz leave the government and the public protests in Israel focus on a single issue. That's the problem. Yeah, we've seen the largest demonstrations in Israel since October 7th, but they represent a broad range of causes. Some want the hostages released. Everyone wants a hostage release. The question is to make it an immediate priority. Some want Netanyahu out. Others demand a ceasefire. Others are protesting the ultra-Orthodox exemption from military service. So until Benny Gantz leaves and the political elites press for a dissolution of the current government, which would allow new elections, and the public pressure identifies a single issue around which they're united, as they did with the judicial reform, which they thwarted before the war, I think there's no mechanism to remove Benjamin Netanyahu, and Joe Biden has very little choice, if he wants to see the conflict ended, of finding a way to, as hard as it is, finding a way to work with rather than try to renounce this Israeli government.
Well, you know, there's a dichotomy there, too. It seems that Benjamin Netanyahu needs to keep the war going in order for his own survival in office and frankly out of jail, right? So there's that, but and there's very minimal support for Netanyahu in the country internally, but the support for the war is quite high. So how does that tension get reconciled?
Well, I mean, I think you're right, but again, Netanyahu's not a sole actor. If you got an Israeli-Hamas deal, you might see a crack in the current government. There are parties in Mr. Netanyahu's coalition which will balk at the asymmetrical number of Palestinians who are going to be released. Hamas wants at least 100 or more of those prisoners, either convicted or charged with killing Israelis. You could see a break and dissension within the government on that issue. But again, there are only two ways to remove the government: either a constructive vote of no confidence, where the parties in the Knesset agree on identify another candidate for prime minister, and that candidate can arguably put together 60 plus one, which is what you need to govern in 120 seat Knesset, or alternatively, the government of Netanyahu, the most extreme right-wing government in the history of the state of Israel, collapses as a consequence of four or five defections. And my argument is that as long as this, and I think you're right about Netanyahu's interest in keeping the war going, not to mention we haven't even talked about the prospects for an escalation along the Israeli-Lebanese border, which, unlike the Israel-Hamas conflict, could actually evolve and trip into a major regional confrontation. So yeah, on trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in a Jerusalem district court before three judges, the trial's 3 years in running. Netanyahu hopes somehow that the longer the war continues, greater the chances that something will happen. They'll kill the senior leadership, they'll release the hostages. Somehow he'll be able to hang on. But there will be an accounting, and there will be accountability once the kinetic phase of the war draws down and people start to focus on what happened on October 7th. It's almost unimaginable that a prime minister presiding over the largest terrorist attack in Israel's history and the bloodiest single day for Jews since the Nazi Holocaust will be able to survive.
And speaking of the issue of containment and what's going on the Lebanese border, and not to mention what might be going on the West Bank, and that's just a conversation we don't have time for today, but the chances for containment of this conflict, how are they in light of the attack that also happened just a few days ago in Syria, in Damascus, at an installation that the Israeli Defense Forces say they took out some Iranian leaders?
Right. Four or five members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, including the most significant leader of all, a guy who manages Iran's covert operations and is the key liaison to Hezbollah, were killed in that strike. Look, if the Iranians were interested in a major escalation, this would offer them that opportunity. But what has kept the conflict contained, quote unquote, is the fact that Tehran has no interest whatsoever in a major confrontation with Israel under these circumstances, which could easily, we have one carrier strike group deployed in the Arabian Sea, and the president, I'm sure, would send another one now. That's over 200 strike aircraft. The Iranians do not want a conflict with the United States, and either does Hezbollah. And Iran's options are very poor. They have no great power allies. The Russians are bogged down in their own war with Ukraine. So Iran, I think, will continue to try to remain under the escalatory threshold that would trigger what the Middle East has never seen before, which is a major confrontation involving Hezbollah, Iran, Israel, and almost certainly the United States. Spiking oil prices, plunging financial markets, and the degree of instability that goes well beyond what we've been watching over the past 6 months between Israel and Hamas in Gaza.
Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Hizakamuna Congregation in Pikesville in an event sponsored by the New Israel Fund. And we've got links to information about that event on our website, wipr.org/midday. Thank you, Aaron. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And up next, it's Midday on the Arts. The acclaimed soprano Nola Richardson joins me with a preview of a concert she's giving this weekend with Pro Musica Rara, an early music ensemble that's been a beloved fixture on the Baltimore music scene for decades. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.